Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose.
Okay, welcome you guys to our Dog Talk live seminar. We have a wonderful panel here this evening for you guys to talk with, not just hear from, but talk with, which is very important. And I think one of the things that in our sport today we have maybe lost a little bit of is the opportunity to do this. And so we're really glad that you guys came and took that opportunity. We have with you this evening Mrs. Pat Trotter, famous.
All the above.
Mr. Andy Linton, Mr. Desmond Murphy, and Mr. Ken Murray. And these are people long in the sport with a lot of knowledge to share. And we're going to be talking about the concept, we'll find out, maybe I'm wrong, developing an eye for a dog. And as I was talking to people about this, they said, can you develop an eye for a dog? Are you born with it, or is it Maybelline?
Okay.
Come on, Andy, just roll with this. Just roll with this. Andy did not say that. I am your host and your moderator, Laura Reeves. And what I think is really important is that you guys get the opportunity to ask some questions, listen to what these folks have to say, and ask some questions, all right? And we're going to be talking about learning how to see a dog. We just had a wire fox in here. Mrs. Trotter, who's been doing this for her entire life, wants to go and put her hands on this dog. That is how we learn. And that's what this opportunity is. So please, our panelists, briefly, thank you very, very much for taking time out of your very long days. We appreciate you. Say thank you. And a brief introduction from each of our panelists, please.
Pat Trotter. I've been in dogs since the late 40s. I registered my first litter of Elkhounds in 1951. I still haven't gotten it totally right yet, so I don't quit.
Andy Linton. I've been showing dogs since the mid-70s is when I started. And been doing this maybe too long, but I love it still. And I'll keep doing it until something starts hurting.
Desi Murphy. I showed my first dog when I was about 6-7 years old, and I've been judging for 42 years.
Ken Murray. I went to my first dog show and showed my first dog in 1959, a Westie, West Highland White Terrier. And I, at those shows, I fell in love with Irish Setters. I bought an Irish Setter, and I showed my first owned dog in 1961 at the Texas Kennel Club.
All right, so we have a good breadth of knowledge here. We're going to start with what is an eye for a dog. Let's define that term. What is an eye for a dog?
An eye for a dog would mean, by definition, can you read the standard of a particular breed, assimilate the standard, and then formulate that picture in your mind? If you have an eye for a dog, you know what a particular breed or dog should look like, should act like, should behave like, and all aspects of that dog. Not just the silhouette or anything, but being able to have that blueprint in your mind and be able to ascertain which dog best fits that blueprint, I think.
I think also talking about developing an eye for a dog, we've seen through the years that many couples, husband and wives, that have started in dogs together. They both bred the dogs together, handled the dogs together. They had the same very experience. But when this couple went on to judge, either the wife or the husband became a great one judge, and the other one was rather mediocre.
Well, I think you definitely have to have mentors to straighten you out as to what's right and what's wrong. And I remember when I was 20 years old, I went to work for a professional handler named Dick Cooper, who was a famous sporting dog handler, did a tremendous amount of winning with Irish Setters. And what I thought was a good Irish Setter in my mind when I was 20 years old, after I was completely wrong. Different dogs I thought were good ones, I realized after talking to him and other people that were authorities in the breed, how off base I was. So you have to have good mentors to straighten you out and teach you what's correct, besides reading the standard and, you know, just going to shows and watching. I mean, it helps if you have an eye for balance, but you definitely need good mentors. Just up to you to find out who knows the most about the breed you're interested in.
You've got three great dog people here, and I know personally these people have an eye for a dog.
Yes.
An eye for a dog is when you see one that gets your attention. It's an arresting animal because it exudes beauty and correctness and almost an artistic thing about it. It's like a work of art, you know? We get people that say, well, I don't know anything about art. I know what I like. I don't want that person buying me a dog. I want that or a piece of art. I want that person who knows what great art is to buy it. And Laura used a very interesting description of this seminar about, are you born with an eye for a dog, or do you develop an eye for a dog? And I think sometimes both of those things can happen. I think in my past I had two ladies that I showed to, and one fit each category. Bea Gotzel was born with an eye for a dog. When she walked into the ring and looked at a class of dogs, if there was nothing in there that jumped out at her, she had to go to work. But if there was one in there that was a great standout, even though it didn't look like the others, she knew what it was. All right? Sometimes great dogs get lost at shows where they're the right look, and they're different from the other dogs who are, shall we say, modest at best or ordinary. And unfortunately, sometimes those dogs do get lost. Now, the other lady I was going to refer to was not born with an eye for a dog, but she developed it. And her name was Ramona Van Court. Ramona never truly understood elk hounds. For years, she'd put up little squatty, dumpy ones and so on. She was way ahead of the curve about going to national specialties. In 1968, when we still got great master breeder judges from Norway, they're not any of them alive anymore because they're not being bred to the same extent. Let's face it, elk hounds take a backseat to greyhounds, poodles, cockers, and a whole lot of others in their home country of Norway. But Ramona went to watch a Norwegian breeder expert judge in 1968, and she never judged elk hounds the same after that. She studied what was going on, what he put up, what he selected for, and I think she became a person who developed an eye for that breed. So what you're saying about the standards and the things you learn and the balance and all of that comes together in the person that has an eye for a dog. Okay.
And Bea Gotzel also, she was a great teacher.
Yes.
Some of our very best judges that learned so much from Bea. She was a brilliant teacher.
I remember one of her quotes, great dogs carry their faults well.
That's right, Ken. Yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
And so, in other words, I think what Bea meant by that, absence of faults doesn't guarantee presence of virtues.
Yeah, I think actually the actual quote might have been that great dogs blind you to their faults, which I think is true. I mean, sometimes we all see a great dog and we miss the little tiny blemish it might have.
And do you think, Desi, to take that to the next step, do you think, what is that line, right? So you've got a great dog with great virtue and maybe it has a great fault. Where's that line? Speak to us.
I personally think faults, that I can live with faults if they don't take away from breed type.
Okay.
You know, if you have a fault, yeah, you're going to be a fault judge. If there's a fault that takes away from breed type,
right,
that's a real fault. I mean...
Okay. Thoughts on that? Andrew?
I agree with you.
Well, every breed has its standards, so
yep.
You're going to have different priorities in every breed.
Right.
So, I mean, if we're going back to, do you have an eye for a dog, and we're going back to that, you have to think about what the priorities are in each breed and try to reward those. And if you're judging a dog or you're ascertaining a dog, if it's good enough to show or special or you know, show it all for that matter,
right.
Or breed it if you're a breeder, you have to know the priorities of that breed and then, of course, the faults and virtues of your dog or the dog you're judging. So having that eye for a dog gives you responsibility so many ways as a handler. Do I take that dog?
Right.
As a judge, do I put that dog up? As a breeder, do I breed that dog? So you become responsible. The more you know, the more responsible you become in any one of those forums.
So for our people here who are aspiring to know more.
Basically, I would say this. Basically, this is all built on which one is closest to the standard. And the one that's closest to the standard is supposed to win. So obviously know your standard and whatever breed it is you're talking about. And really, I find this interesting. I can read even a breed that I live, Dobermans, for example. I'll read the standard this week, and I might read it next week, and I might gain more and have a little different, ever so slight maybe, but a little slightly different perspective. And you gain perspective every time you study your breed, whether it's talking to somebody who might have a different perspective, whether it's reading your standard 10 times. You'll come away with a little bit each time. So like Pat here is the eternal student, even though she's the teacher.
There's a lot of students at this table, actually.
Yeah. I mean, all of us love to learn. That goes without saying. I've talked to these guys for a million years. And
well, then you also have to take into consideration, you have to have the dog trained properly. You have to have it in show condition. And you have to know what you're doing when you're in the ring.
Well, a lot of people that I know in here have heard me say this, but dog shows are won and lost on three things: quality, condition, and presentation in the long run. I'm not saying judges always get it right, because they don't. But if I didn't believe in the long run that quality, condition, and presentation won dog shows, again, in the long run, not every dog show, but that's where you have to focus. If I maintain that attitude of quality, condition, and presentations wins the dog shows. When I lose, if I think to myself, okay, was my dog in perfect condition? Did I have it trimmed to the best of its ability? Did I make any mistakes? I've never shown a dog perfectly. So, you know, that opens up the door to losing when you make a mistake. You didn't have your dog at the right angle. You moved them too fast, too slow. You choked them a little too much here and there.
I think the point that Andy's making is an excellent point. He's made it on another podcast that we had, Bill and Andy and Valerie. That on the podcast in the interview and talked about winning at Westminster and all this other stuff, but he made that same point there, and it's one of the reasons I asked him to come tonight, because it's such a valuable point.
You'd like somebody to talk on losing at Westminster.
The greatest loser of all time. How many group firsts at Westminster?
11?
11 group firsts at Westminster.
As an owner handler.
My one time I beat her. I'm sorry.
You feel bad about that.
If I could give it back to you. But, yeah.
Okay. All right. So next step. Let's take the next step here. So we said what an eye for a dog is, and maybe you have it, maybe you develop it. How you develop it. How do you apply it?
Judges.
You mean as a breeder?
As a breeder, as a handler, as a judge. Andy mentioned it briefly, but I want to expand on that just a little bit.
Well, first of all, as a breeder, you need to get a feel, like Desi said, you need to understand breed type. You need to understand that each one of these breeds in the beginning, except for a few lap dogs and others perhaps, but even some lap dogs in the days before pesticides, had a job description: sit in the queen's lap and draw the fleas. Okay? So whatever. But once you find out that a given dog evolved into a given form because it was doing a given job better than other dogs of that era, you start to understand that dogs that have lateral movement have to have short loins. You start to get a feel for relationship of the parts. And I don't care whether you like art or you like abstract stuff like some of the more modern artists have done, where eyes are floating in space and stuff like that. The bottom line is you have to know what it takes to put the parts together to do a job description. And I personally feel in my breed A fault that's a little cosmetic troubles me a lot less than a fault that compromises functional ability. That's me and a personal, and that's how I judge, too. I mean, I want them to have that type that when they come in the ring, they jump out at me. But sometimes you have to make, shall we say, you have to make some compromises to get a dog that's right for breeding stock. And we're supposed to be addressing breeding stock. Some things are easier to fix than others. And it's just like Desi said, you can't judge on faults. You've got to pick the dog that has the collection of virtues. That's what you have to pick. And those are not always easy to find.
Desi?
Yeah, and I think Kenny...
Desi, what do you think on that?
Kenny could probably explain something better than I'll be able to. But, I mean, you also have to take the function of a dog and where they work.
That's right.
Like, you take the three setters. Basically, it is pretty much the same in outline. But I think it was Elliot Weiss one time when he was talking about the differences. You know, the Gordon is like a dirt bike. You know, they work in a hard terrain up in Scotland, so you need big, robust
swampy
dog. Yeah. The English setter, he compared to like a leisure bike, regular type of bike. And then the Irish setter that worked on an open field is like a racing bike. And it makes the difference. Here's the three breeds with basically the same outline, but it's the way those dogs work distinguishes their type.
Yeah. When English setters hunt, or when you go out with an English setter, they quarter, which means they go work a field like this, back and forth like this. Yeah. And English setters hunt right out in front of you.
Right.
Irish setters, you have to be on a horse because they're,
half
a mile down the road.
Right.
Gordon setters in Scotland, it was called bogs or swampy areas.
Yeah.
That's why they were heavier bone because they had to lift their legs up through
thicker
horrible
cover.
Ground.
Yeah.
And the Gordon setter standard calls for a high head carriage. You never want to put a Gordon setter up going around the ring with his head down. They calls for a high head carriage. That's part of the movement that they have.
Right, absolutely. Okay, so questions. Young lady.
What about the Irish red and white?
The Irish red and white setter type differences. Kenny.
Well, they're finer bone than any one of the other three setters. Markings are important. You know. To tell you the truth, I haven't seen a whole lot of quality in that breed. I mean, maybe there is in England or something like that.
It's rare we ever see any. Since they've been recognized, I've probably maybe judged 15 of them in all these years. You just don't see them. And most of the ones you see are usually pretty lacking. We have seen a few really good ones. And it's a shame the breed has not become more popular. Were they not, wasn't the original Irish setter red and white?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, additional questions. Sir?
You mentioned earlier about having your exceptional dog in a sea of, judging an exceptional dog in a sea of, for lack of a better term, mediocrity.
Right.
And sometimes that exceptional dog can get lost. How do, if I feel that I've got an exceptional dog, of course, how do I keep my dog from getting lost?
Great question.
You seek out the judges that you think.
Have an eye for a judge.
Yeah. I love it. An eye for a judge. Perfect.
I like that. Thank you, Bill, for that contribution.
That's exactly right.
Go ahead, Pat.
Well, you might want to, as Bill said, have an eye for the judge. That means you think in terms of what judge might you let buy you a dog if you had a blank check and they were going to the native country, you know?
What if you don't know?
Make it your business to find out.
You know, going back to the original thing, developing an eye for a dog, I mean, there's certain things when I was in school, there were certain subjects, no matter how hard I studied, went to summer school, failed summer school, took the course over the next year, and I continued to fail. I mean, there were certain subjects, if I went to school for 10 years on that subject, I would never have been any good. I mean, it's like judges are like dogs. You have excellent, very good, good, satisfactory, unsatisfactory. And you're never going to make some of these people, no matter how hard they study, they're never going to be a great judge.
You have to be obsessed with the whole sport. When I was a kid, 12, 13, 14 years old, I used to take the bus
the downtown, I grew up in Dallas, Texas, to the public library there, and I'd check out years worth of Popular Dogs magazines, and I'd sit there all Saturday afternoon reading Popular Dogs magazines. My mother hired a psychologist. She thought it was a problem.
I hear you. I did the same thing.
There's exactly.
I think we have all done that.
Yeah. There's a very successful young man in Pekingese, David Fitzpatrick, you all know. When David was about 11, 12 years old, there was a lady down the block, Hermine Cleaver, and she hired David to come and clean out her garage. Should have taken 2 hours. It took well over a week because he had to read every Popular Dogs before he took it out of the garage.
Absolutely. Okay, so does that kind of give you an answer, or do you want to have a follow-up for that?
I hear what you're saying. How do you sort them out?
Who do you ask?
Well, I suppose you could ask some of the people that you know are people of high quality and integrity that show dogs and have a lot of success, because sometimes you have to learn for yourself. I'm sure all of us here have kept logs on judges. Logs on judges. We didn't have all that stuff in the day. And the bottom line is, and it even can, when you're a knowledgeable breeder, it can even guide you to have a log. Because sometimes you will have a different dog than what you have had. You go and you lose under a judge. All right, he doesn't like that particular kind of dog. Maybe he's a headhunter in your breed, or maybe he's a guy that's totally unforgiving on the down and back. So you don't show him this dog, but when you get another one, you try it. You cannot determine whether a judge is going to like what you have until you show him enough dogs to get a feel for it. One of the problems we're having in dogs today is that there aren't great lines of dogs for breeders to go to. The breedings are random anymore. When I moved out here, in 1962 as I was a young school teacher, and I stayed out here because my line of dogs at the time were light on bone and head. And there was a kennel called Greenwood up in the Pacific Northwest. And the first time I saw any of their dogs at the Santa Barbara show in the day when that was quite a show, all those dogs had bone and head and feet. And I said, I'm going to stay out here because I need those dogs. So as you grow in dogs and mature in dogs, first of all, you learn what your dogs need to improve. And you seek out those dogs that are strong where yours have needs. And then you seek out judges that understand the same thing. You want to remember that most of your judges have either been really top handlers or they've been breeders. And in the old days, there was more opportunity for people to become great breeders than there is today. It wasn't so hard to keep dogs. There wasn't such legislation against them. Your vet bills didn't send both kids of the vets to college. I mean, you know, things were different. So you're going to have to work hard at it. But you can ask old-time breeders, too. People that have been kicking around the sport forever and have had some success. Those are the people you might ask. But you shouldn't judge a judge, eye for a judge. Your definition of a judge should never be, a good judge is one who puts me up, a bad judge is one who doesn't. When you do that, you drop the wall to improving your learning ability. And I think one thing that helps breeders is to look at your own dogs with a jaded eye. Appreciate the great. You don't want the great, but look at them with a jaded eye and see their shortcomings. And look at your competition through rose-colored glasses. That will help you advance in your efforts to become a better evaluator as a breeder and exhibitor.
One other thing, if you feel like you're in that situation where you've got the outstanding dog and there's four other ones that are the same but they're not good and you're losing to those, do this. Like, if I were in that situation, I'd say, hey, Bill, can you come watch, you know, Vizsla's today?
What am I missing?
Yeah, am I missing something in my quality, condition, or presentation?
Right.
Where's the hole?
Yep.
Nowadays, we have the technology to have some video.
Exactly. And then,
you may not realize what you're doing. You may think you're doing what's right and not be doing it.
That's a great tool, but also have somebody else look at it. And like you're saying, I know mine's the best. Well, maybe not. So be real about it and have an objective expert maybe give you their opinion. And they might say, hey, look, you know, you're moving your dog like so fast, the judge is never going to point at the dog going like that. And so get an objective expert to evaluate your situation, and they might be able to just tell you right now.
Did we do good?
What do you think of us? What's your opinion? What did you like about us? Kenny, you told me you couldn't talk. I think you're a big fat liar. You did just awesome. You did a great job.
Yay!
Thank you guys all very much. I know it's been a very long day, and I appreciate the time tremendously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, crew, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. She has another one of her outstanding tips of the week for us today. So welcome, Allison.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Very good. So what are we learning about today?
Well, today I'm going to give you two little tidbits that really have helped me in my years with dogs.
Okay.
So the first one is for dogs, usually males, but sometimes females, that have really strong smelling urine. And also the urine really stains a white coat. So, you know, clumbers mm-hmm. that pee on their yep. front legs and furnishings, English setters that pee yep. on their furnishings, even, you know, English setter girls or American mm-hmm. cocker girls mm-hmm. or have a knees or like pee on their feathering mm-hmm. and get a lot of staining there because it just seems their urine is very dark.
Right.
So I use apple cider vinegar.
I love apple cider vinegar.
Yes. So I put a little bit of apple cider vinegar in their water. So like all of their water that they have access to has, you know, like for a 2-quart bucket, like a tablespoon of apple cider vinegar in it.
Right.
And you'll notice in about 10 days that their urine doesn't have that strong smell anymore. And then if you're paying attention and like washing out the staining and stuff like that, you'll find that their urine isn't staining either at all or as badly.
Absolutely.
It changes the pH. You do have to be a little bit careful because some dogs really, really hate the taste of it.
Right.
And so you have to make sure they are drinking the water and that you don't overdo it. So I always start, you know, with like about a quarter of where I want to be for the first 2 days, then like half of a tablespoon. And then, you know, depending mm-hmm. on how big the container mm-hmm. is that mm-hmm. they're drinking out of it, how often you change it, etc.
Yep.
So you do have to watch that, but it does work the trick. Like you will really, really like it.
I love it. I use it on, go back to Clumbers, eye stains, Clumbers, yeah. White Akitas. Any of those dogs that have, like your Bichon or anything like that, where they get a little yeah. bit of weepy eyes and that clears those eye stains in a heartbeat.
Yeah, it really does help the pH and really does change things, so it's great.
Yeah. Next one.
So the other one is, because I was thinking about water, mm-hmm. is I do have dogs, like especially during a show, that just don't seem to want to drink water during the day. And like, you know that they're thirsty, they're panting, you're in a warm building, but just for whatever reason, mm-hmm. you know, you offer them water and they don't take it. So this is a tip from Australian friends of mine that they're always giving their dogs water throughout the day because their dog shows are outside and it's always hot, right?
Yeah,
at their
right,
shows.
Right.
So adding a little bit of milk. So I'm talking about like even like an eighth of a cup of milk. I've even used the little creamers from the concession, and I've used those and put those in the water. And I don't know what it is, and nobody has ever been able to explain it to me, but you'll offer them the water, they turn their nose away, you put a little bit of milk in, and they drink water.
Wow. I like it. I like that better because I've used, like, sometimes broth, you know, but usually that has so much salt, it's almost, like, pointless, right?
Right. And I do really like it because, you know, I just get concerned during the day when you know your dog is thirsty, but they just have this thing that they're not going to drink that water. And even you give them fresh water, you give them ice cubes, mm-hmm. and it just seems you put a little bit of milk in there and they just drink like normal. And, you know, the milk is going to help them, but it's not going to hurt. So anyway, next time your dog doesn't feel like drinking water and you're like saying, I really would like them to take a drink, put a little dab of milk in there and just see what happens.
I wish I'd known that when I was showing the Saluki that only knew how to drink out of a toilet. Actually, not kidding. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Allison. I appreciate it. Listeners, don't forget, Pure Dog Talk 25 in your checkout code for one of Allison's Leading Edge Academy courses, and that gives you a 25% discount on the cost of your course. I think you can probably get at least a cup of coffee out of that.
Yeah, more than a cup of coffee.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Allison.
Thanks, Laura.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the Dog Show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.